Sunday night. That means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to 184th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The links to the recordings of the previous 183 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. Then look under the radio show tab. As I've said on the air for the last 6 months, my last piece for the Western Guardian, the 212th Integrative Disruption Series, is still available after more than 6 months at the website www.westernguardian.com. And Western Guardian is WESTCHESTERGUARDIN. It was hopefully left up there to be read by every living American, and I, of course, hope they do. It's the last of a Creative Disruption series in the paper, as after the September 29th issue of the paper, the Western Guardian joined the ranks of New York Herald Tribune, Washington Star, New York Journal American, and Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. The issue also contains columns by ex-congressperson and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try to subscribe only one email per day, and it's free. www.johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join us tonight and every week. Next week, my guest will be attorney and president of Monroe College, Mark Jerome. And every week we're on at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sundays, either live or as most do listen to it later. Then now to this week's show, the 184th, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that is 646-716-9756. But I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is an old friend, author, musician, singer, NPR commentator, entrepreneur, and founder of New York City's conferencing system and social network, Echo. That's Stacey Horn. That's a lot to put one's arms around tonight, but we'll try to touch all those bases on tonight's John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Stacey. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
A lot to talk about, but let's start right at the beginning. You're both the writer and a musician. Were these interests as a young child?
I don't know that I would call myself a musician, though. Yeah, I've always been interested in music, but I started drumming, I guess, around when I turned 40. When I first moved back to New York, I went to the Village Halloween Parade, and a group of, 50 or 100 drummers went by, and I was just possessed by the sound of all percussion. And it was just something I always wanted to do. And then one Halloween, I went up to the drummers afterwards, and I said, can I learn how to do this? And they gave classes, and I learned how to drum, and then started drumming every year in the Halloween parade myself. It's with the samba band, Manhattan Samba.
Did you write when you were young, be interested in writing as a career?
I have wanted to be a writer since I was 9 years old, and I will never forget it. It was in school, and one of the students in my class got up in front of the class and read something that she had written, a story. And this just blew my mind because I loved reading, but it just, it had never occurred to me, like, oh my God, we can write these things ourselves? I mean, what a brilliant, fun idea. And ever since then, I wanted to be a writer.
I started even younger than that. I used to make up stories about the comic characters that I read about in the Sunday papers, Allie Oop and Dick Tracy and people like that. Where'd you go to early school?
You mean like grammar school?
Yeah, grammar school, all the way back.
Well, I grew up on Long Island, and so I went in Huntington, and so I went to a place called Flower Hill Elementary School.
And then where to high school? Also local?
Yep, Huntington High School, you know, all public schools, nothing special.
Now,
they were horrible.
Now, all the things that you're interested in, and then and now we want school papers, yearbooks, glee club, etc. In your grammar, in high school years.
You know, I was never as organized as that. It always amazes me, you know, when I see young people today. They're, you know, they've been working for whatever they wanted their entire lives. They're just much more organized and ambitious and aggressive. I mean, when I was growing up, I was partying and going to concerts and thinking, you know, I'll figure all this out later when I'm an adult. And it wasn't something that, you know, college was to have a good time. So, no, I lucked out that I was even able to do any of the things I wanted, given how little I prepared for them.
I was exactly the same way. I was so lucky that I got into a career that I didn't even know anything about or care about, into technology, through luck, as an English major. And where'd you go to college?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I often just fell into things. Like after college, when I moved back to New York, I was looking for a job, and there was this was 1981 or 80, that time frame, and there was an ad for a job that said someone who works as well with machines as they do people. That was it. That was the ad. And it was so interesting that I answered the ad and went for an interview, even though I didn't know what they meant, and I had no experience working with any kind of machines. And it turned out it was a job for a computer telecommunications company, very early, early telecommunications company, and they would teach me how to hook up people, you know, around New York and surrounding areas to computers in New York.
You're even ahead of me. Where did you go to college?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Because I was such a terrible student who really didn't bother in high school, when I was in my last year, and other people, you know, had already gone through and applied for colleges very faithfully and diligently, and I hadn't. And I realized, oh my God, what am I going to do? I work at McDonald's? That doesn't sound fun. So I applied to a bunch of colleges that would take someone with like me who didn't have very good grades, and I just went to the first place that accepted me, a place called the Florida Institute of Technology. And which is actually a very good school and not easy to get into, but they had opened this experimental college at another campus to train not marine biologists, but the people who would work on the boats collecting the samples to take back to the marine biologists in the lab, so like field workers. And that actually sounded more fun to me. And, you know, I grew up on Long Island on boats and on the water, so getting a job on the water like that sounded fun. So I went down to Florida, started school there, and taking a course in photography was a required course so that you could then go on to underwater photography and take pictures when needed. And I loved the photography so much that I dropped the Florida Institute of Technology, looked around for another school where I could, you know, major in photography. And I picked Ohio University, which may sound like a weird choice, but they had a very, and still might for all I know, but a very exciting photography program with a lot of interesting teachers. So I jumped up there, went there for a year, and then I thought, where can I go that's even better? And from there, I switched to the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, which had this dual program where you took your studio classes at the Museum of Fine Arts and your academic courses at Tufts University, and you would end up with a degree, a BFA, from Tufts University.
Which is interesting because next week, my guest, Mark Jerome, the president of Monroe College, is a Tufts graduate.
Ah.
He's also an attorney. He went to Penn after that. And Barbara and I had an affiliation with Tufts. Barbara did anyhow for a year and a half. She was the dean of online learning at Tufts, or the director of it. And we had an apartment in Medford where I'd spend the weekend if I came up, if she didn't come home, and she was there all week. So they've got all these Tufts connections. So
that had to have been later, though. I went to school there in the 70s.
Yeah, it was later. It was in the late 90s, 2000. But it was interesting. So then you have all these things that you've taken from Ohio University, by the way, that has a well-known English program.
I had some great teachers there.
And then Tufts. And then what did you do?
So then I moved back to the city and just completely fell into computers. And I learned all about telecommunications, just, again, completely by accident. And that's how this led to me to Echo, but again, completely by accident. So I hopped around from job to job, and ultimately I was working for the Mobil Corporation. That's what they were called at the time, the oil company. And I was, I was a telecommunications analyst and designing their networks and hooking up, people who work for Mobil around the country to their main data centers. And I was miserable, absolutely miserable. I still wanted to be a writer, and I just didn't know how I ended up, as a telecommunications analyst. It was just so weird. I mean, it was interesting at first, but then it was just not. And one of the heads of corporate telecommunications walked into my office one day, and he said, "Stacy, you're never going to move up the corporate ladder unless you have a graduate degree." And he walked out, and I thought, well, moving up the corporate ladder is the last thing in the world I want to do. But graduate school sounded fun. Like, I didn't know how to get out. I didn't know how to, make the next move, and just graduate school sounded like a good place to just mull it over. And so I picked a graduate program only because it had the word telecommunications in the title. It was the Interactive Telecommunications Program at NYU. And I didn't really know what it was, but again, it had telecommunications in the title, so I knew Mobil would pay for it, and I didn't have to take the GRE to get in. So I went to school there, and I don't know if you know about the program, but its home is the Tisch School of the Arts. So the orientation is arts, not business. And it's just this wonderful new media playground where people were just exploring anything to do with new media and the internet. And one of my early assignments was to call an online service called The Well in California. I'm sure you've heard of The Well, but it's this wonderful online community that started about the time, I think, when I started graduate school, sometime in the 1980s. And it was wonderful. It was just filled with all these really smart, interesting people that I would never get to meet otherwise. So I kept calling The Well long after that class was over and all through, going to graduate school. And I was in my last semester, logged on to The Well, when someone said, "Oh, we heard you're going to East Coast version of The Well in New York." And I had never said or even considered any such thing. But as soon as they said it, I went, It was like being back in grade school and that girl getting up in front of the class and reading her own story. You know, everyone has these great ideas before I do. But when he said it, I went, yeah, I am. That's exactly what I'm doing. That's what I'm working on. And I dropped a bunch of courses so that I could take courses that would help me do that, like writing a business plan. And I wrote a business plan during my last semester, and I incorporated that summer. That was 1989.
While the Morty's coincidence, my son's a screenwriting degree is from Tisch, so he was there. He would have been there. I guess just after you, and then I was on the well from almost the beginning, because I was active in the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference that the both of us, a bunch of us, set up out in California, and I remember you when you were starting it, and we talked about it, and two of your early public appearances were at I was the president of the New York Apple User Group at the time, and the chairperson of the or the program chairperson of the New York IBM Group, and you spoke that both about what you hope to do with the
oh my God, Echo. Do you have any memory of that?
I certainly do.
Because I remember in the beginning, I mean, it really was a nightmare trying to get Echo off the ground. First, I couldn't get anyone to invest in me. I mean, I got laughed out of every office I went into, because at the time, the idea of people wanting to communicate over the computer, they just thought no one's going to want to do that except for a bunch of geeky losers. It's never going to take off. And I remember looking at them going, you just have to do it to see that this is going to rule the world. And I wasn't a visionary. I mean, you were there at the time. If you did it, if you tried it out, it was just immediately obvious how much fun it was and how important it could be. Actually, at the time, I tried to get mobile to get into it. I tried to set up a computer conferencing system on mobile, and I don't know if this is at all interesting, but it was to me, only because it failed completely, and I learned a lot about that because of that failure and why it failed. But I don't know, should I tell the story, because it's kind of interesting? But
sure.
As soon as I, you know, got on the well and saw how cool it was, I came up with an immediate application that could be used at mobile. My job was to design networks to connect people to mainframes that were in Dallas and Princeton, New Jersey. And at the time, you know, this was pre-divestiture. So it was coordinating, you know, phone lines being installed across the country and locally, and modems being installed, computers being installed, controllers, all sorts of equipment, some of not even used anymore. And it was kind of a nightmare, because I might be installing a line between New York and California with 10 stops, 10 offices along the way. And coordinating these installations was just, again, very, very difficult, because it involved a lot of different people, a lot of different places who were arriving at different times. And it was just hard to keep track of who was doing what and when, and what they were, if they were succeeding and what was going wrong. So I thought, if we have like an online space, people can check in, let me know that they've gotten there, let me know what they've done, and let me know what they haven't done. And so this would be ongoing. They would log in whenever, because again, it was across time zones, so it was all different times. And I could just constantly have this update that I could see any time of day or night what was going on, what was going wrong, and I could address it. So the way things happened at mobile is there were these, I believe, weekly meetings with everyone in the data communications group. And at the time, I was the only woman. So there'd be this long conference table of men and me. And people would talk about what they were doing and bring up ideas. So I stood up and brought up this idea we should have this online computer conference, and I explained to them just what I explained to you. They laughed at me. No, it's stupid. Nobody's ever going to use it, blah, blah, blah. And so week after week, I would come up with different ways to present it, trying to convince them that this was the future and it really is going to take off and it's going to be very, very useful and important. And I never could. So finally, I went into the head of corporate telecommunications at Mobile, and I said, look, nobody believes me. I get that. They're never going to believe me. Give me a chance to prove it. Let me just set up a pilot system and just show you how great it can be. And he said, okay, prove it. So I set it up, and it failed miserably. And I learned later that various managers in New York and across the country had quietly agreed that they were going to make sure it failed. And I was shocked, and at first I couldn't figure out why. And then I realized finally that what I saw as this great thing, because any mistakes and problems would be immediately apparent so I could fix them, they saw as any mistakes and problems that they caused would be immediately exposed.
To be out in the open, yeah.
Yeah.
It was interesting because to what I got immediately out of the well was that it was that we had reached beyond where it was just the computer professional and the hobbyist groups. It was in the semi-mainstream. So it was in addition to technology types. There were the grateful deadheads, there were the community activists,
yeah.
There were psychologists, there were writers. And that goes. Now, for people living in New York, though, there was no worldwide cheap communication network then. So we had to log in either call long distance that was prohibitively expensive, or we had to log in to the now called TimeNet. And there was a fairly high charge there. Was the cost of connection from New York one of the reasons that you thought a local conferencing system could go at that time?
Well, actually, now I remember why I asked you if you remembered anything about me getting up, because when I started Echo, I couldn't get any money because nobody would believe me that the internet would ever be a thing. So I started it with the savings and severance package I got when Mobile moved to Virginia. At the time that I incorporated Mobile,
I remember that.
Announced that they were moving to Virginia, so I got this nice little package, and I used that to finance the beginning of Echo. And I ran it out of my apartment. And I did everything I could to promote it, but you remember, but your listeners may not remember, but this was 1989. And a few people had computers. Those that did, no one had modems. I mean, maybe a small handful of people who studied computer science in college had modems and were on bulletin board systems. So I had to go out and convince people to buy a modem and to buy one of these services so that they could log in using their phone line. And it was just, I would get up in front of every group that would let me and try to talk people into this, and I just was really bad at it. And I remember I took a public speaking course, and I did all these things to try to figure out how to make this more appealing to people, and I just slowly got better at representing it. And I don't know if you saw these times that you're remembering or at the times when I was struggling
you
to
were actually
present it.
You're actually better than you remember. You were vivacious and you were enthusiastic. The problem was that you didn't have the user base. So when you get people all excited and they say, well, how many people are on? And you'd say, well, there's three people from down the block and there's the people from across the street. And so
exactly.
you needed the base to get a base. And that was very difficult.
Well, I lucked out. Ultimately, I was getting people on one by one by one. It was just insane. I would have gone under. And I always credit Clinton and Gore for rescuing Echo. They were elected, and all of a sudden they were talking about the information superhighway. Everywhere they went, it was the information superhighway and this great new thing. And it hit, people started being aware of the internet, although they thought of it as the Information Superhighway. And they were aware that there was this thing out there that was kind of cool, and they better, you know, get on or they were going to miss the boat. And so it became, instead of me trying to convince them about the internet, they were already convinced. So I would show up and I'd go, Echo is a stop on the Information Superhighway. And people are like, great, here's a way in. Because they didn't even know where to begin or how to begin. And so I was offering them this launching pad onto the internet. And I offered classes out of my apartment to teach people how to navigate and get around, you know, and not just on Echo, but anywhere. I was teaching people Unix commands.
Even though there were certainly similarities between the Well and Echo, it didn't take long for Echo to develop its own unique personality, largely based in New York City culture. Tell us about that, how you skewed it toward the New
well,
York
that was
culture.
On purpose. That was definitely on purpose. One of the joys for me of the Well was that it had a different culture. It had a different feel than anything that I had experienced before. You know, when you logged onto the Well, you definitely felt like you were on the West Coast and in that culture, you know, with the Deadheads and everything else. And there, and the best of that culture, it was, as you said, it was like very smart, interesting, eclectic group of people. So I thought, I want to do the same thing. Like, what's the good of going online and going somewhere if you don't feel like you've gone somewhere different? So I wanted Echo to retain a New York City feel. So I never actually marketed it to anyone outside of New York. Like, I hoped that people outside of New York would become members. But I mostly thought of it as like a local service. And that was also because one of the frustrations about the Well was when I would get to know these people that I'd met online, I would want to meet them in person. I wanted to make friends with them, you know, in real life as well as online. And that just wasn't an easy thing to do. So Echo, I thought, you know, I'll make it mostly New Yorkers. So if we like each other, we can be friends in person as well.
You actually advocated that, whereas the Well didn't. Many of the West Coast people knew each other. And I used to write for one of the publications on the West Coast, the Micro Times, that Mary Eisen had, who's on Facebook had. But they didn't advocate meeting people and hanging out, whereas you advocated theater trips and bowling and pizza parties.
Oh my God,
and all that. So
everything I could possibly think of to get people together in person. That was fun too. That was like, you know, I never could have predicted that, but I just anything I could think of. So we had an independent film series, and I would, you know, find an independent filmmaker and we would premiere their film and then have a party afterwards, and then they would come online so people could talk to them at the film online. We had a reading series because it naturally, you know, these early networks attracted people who were comfortable writing, so a lot of writers found their way online, and so we had a reading series and we'd have writers read from their books. And God, more than I can remember, the Dinner Theater of the Mind, it was like a cultural conversation. I think that was at PS 122, but yeah, a ton of things. That was fun. That was a lot of fun.
Can I know, to me, you mentioned something I had forgotten, the venture with the Sci-Fi Channel. Tell us about that.
Oh God, yeah. When I was a graduate student, some students, fellow students, NYU had a television channel. It was like a cable channel, public access channel. And Dan Sullivan and I forget who else were the early creators, but we had this show based on this little world called the Yorb. And people could call up the show, and then using the keypad on the phone, on their phone, they could navigate this world that was on their television. And it was a lot of fun. And it gave me this idea, and another fellow graduate student, Charlene Smith, who worked at the Sci-Fi Channel at the time, and I don't know what I don't remember what the department was, but it was like a new media technology department where they came up with ideas like this. And so we thought, wouldn't it be fun if we did like a Mystery Science Theater type program where, you know, you'd have a program airing and what people were saying in a chat room could scroll across the bottom of the screen. Now this is like done all the time and it's completely normal. But this was, I think, 1993 or 1994. So they were airing the British science fiction program, The Prisoner, and it was late at night, I forget, after midnight. And they thought, okay, we'll try it, but we'll try it at this late hour. So we hooked it up so that what people were saying in chat on Echo would scroll across the bottom of the screen. But they were commenting on the show, like Mystery Science Theater, and they were saying serious things, funny things, you know, insightful things. And someone at the Sci-Fi Channel was picking and choosing. You know, like there was a bunch of people on Echo commenting, and they would just filter through their favorites, and those would scroll across the bottom of the screen. And it was great. I thought it was fun, and I thought it worked very well, but they didn't continue it beyond the experiment.
If I'm correct, The Prisoner was the second show in the series that began with Secret Agent Man. Do you remember that? That was the first show. And then all of a sudden, they didn't know what was going on because he apparently had a nervous breakdown and he was a prisoner and he couldn't get out and all that. So it was very interesting.
Yeah.
I also wrote a book about the Echo experience, focusing on unexpected things that resulted from Echo interactive relationships. Give us an overview of that book, if you will.
Well, that I finally got to be a writer. John Markoff, who was writing for The Times, and he, do you remember these things called doers profiles? They were these small, quick snapshot type business profiles in the business section of The Times.
Yep.
So he did a profile of me, and I forget what the question was, but my answer was I want to be a writer, and I've got an unpublished novel sitting in my desk right now. And the next day, or 2 days, I got a call from Warner Books saying, we will publish your novel. And it turns out, so I sent them my novel, and they didn't love it, but they actually liked my writing. So they said, why didn't you write about this internet thing? Again, this is like the early 90s. And so I said, okay. And I came up with this idea for writing like this overview of the early years of the internet and you know, online culture. But I kept starting it, and I just couldn't get excited about it. And so finally I said to the president of Warner Books at the time, would it be all right if I just not write the book we talked about and just write about Echo? It's this really strange, quirky, small town online, and it's just a lot more interesting, you know, the things that I'm dealing with, trying to manage people who, and what happens when people get together online. Because at the time, everyone was talking about cyberspace as this, like, virtual utopia. People are going to get online and get to really be themselves and get to really know each other, and it's going to break down these cultural boundaries and these political boundaries and solve all the world's problems. I mean, this is really how people were talking, and I understood it because I partly believed it too. But what I learned was, you know, people do not, you know, turn into, you know, perfect beings when they get online. You know, if they've got problems, they bring them with them when they get online, and they tend to recreate these problems of the world in the virtual world. So I had all these, you know, wonderful ideas of this great place I was going to create, and I think I did manage to create that with all the people. Like, I didn't create it. It was the community that created it, really. But there were all these problems. Like, people would get online and fight and do terrible things to each other and say terrible things to each other. Again, like, any baggage you have, you brought it online, and then I had to deal with it. And I wasn't prepared for that. I have no particular skills as a mediator or to deal with, you know, the issues for people who had mental disorders that would find their way online. So I wrote a book about all the problems I had and what I did or did not do about them and mistakes that I had made.
It's interesting. The two things that jumped out at me as I went along. Number one, you eliminate the things that initially make a difference to us. We don't see race. We don't see attractiveness. We don't see height, weight, whatever. So you immediately get deeper into the person's personality. The negative thing is that there's no accountability, whereas there are things that give us pause in the physical world that we won't say something terribly hurtful. We'll be afraid of getting punched in the mouth. We'll be afraid of people coming back to us. We have our own thing. So it was both as Charles Dickens said, it was the best of times and the worst of times.
There was some. I lucked out again in that it was a local service, so that there was accountability to a certain extent. The first thing I did was there was no anonymity. You had to, if you were going to say something ugly, everyone was going to know exactly who said it. Everyone went by their real name on Echo. You could play around and use pseudonyms, but everyone could see what your real name was. So nobody was anonymous. So that tempered it a little bit. And also because I had all these things where people were getting together in person, so it's a little harder to say something terrible when you know you're going to see someone. Yeah, so that helped me.
One of the most interesting things, I taught the first online type of course. It was on a MOO at Marist College. There was a in the capstone course for the graduates. Program was supposed to bring all the computer people together and trade on their backgrounds. Well, many of them worked for IBM, and the year before, they were all of a sudden they were displaced all over the country to Dallas and to Austin and to Raleigh and so. But it was time for the capstone course. We didn't want them all just showing up at some local college and say, what do you have like this? So I was able to put together this online course. So I had I'd meet with them every Sunday from 11 to 2. So one Sunday, and I'd come in and how are you doing? How was your weekend and all this? And there was the fellow down in Austin said, oh, gee, it got very warm here. I was outside working yesterday and boy, to my brown, and the guy, and Rolly said, I'm always brown. And it had never come up. Mm-hmm. It had never come up. There was a difference. All of a sudden, it was like this hit me in the face that this is a terrific place that might help us beat many of the problems that we're associated with. Obviously, it didn't, but there was the potential. You now have five nonfiction books and have a sixth in progress. Take us through the ones after the Echo one, the only technology based one to date. Two are quite personal, and one took us to another aspect of your life. Let's start with the morbid the memoir.
Well, I actually wanted to write a book about death. I've always been very terrified of the idea that we all have to die someday. I think it really sucks. And I wanted to explore that topic, and nobody wanted to publish a book about death, so I figured I have to disguise it. And so I wrote a proposal for a book called Waiting for My Cats to Die, which was going to be a memoir just about my life and dealing with these. I had two cats at the time that both happened to have diabetes and all the trials and tribulations of taking care of these cats. And this book is so hard to explain. It's a very eclectic, strange little book, but what it's really about is not wanting to die. So in between telling these stories, I was researching that subject and weaving it in. And that's what that's about.
One of our cats just died this morning at the age
of
17. Well, she had a good life here. I remember you telling me for years that one of your goals was to be on the same performing stage with a certain rock icon group. Tell us about your music career, your singing, and tell us about this drumming performance and singing.
I'm not sure what you're referring to. Is that Eric Clapton?
Yeah.
I just have the worst memory. I don't even remember how that came about, but the band that I was drumming with, Manhattan Samba, we were invited to drum as backup for Eric Clapton one night, and all I remember is that, you know, we were told to like march down the aisles through the audience to the stage, and then we were doing samba drumming, you know, below Eric Clapton, who was up there playing his guitar, and I just like, I was starstruck. I'm just like drumming and like a deer in headlights, like looking at Eric Clapton just feet from me playing guitar. It was pretty amazing.
He didn't ask you to join the Who or anything, huh?
No.
But you also have gotten him to singing both at the church chorale and to writing the book about singing with others. Tell us about both the book and how you got into singing like this.
Well, I got into singing, I was in my 20s, and, you know, I'd moved back to New York after college, and I was working in this job in computers, which it was interesting, but still, it wasn't what I had planned. I wanted to be a writer, and I was just I was in this terrible depression, and I was just doing all the wrong things to deal with the depression. I was drinking, and I ended up drinking like an alcoholic, and sleeping with all the wrong guys. I mean, I was just really heading downhill fast. And I just will never forget sitting in my living room, rocking back and forth, crying. Like, I knew, you know, I was sinking fast. I just didn't know what to do. And I made a list of things that made me happy. And I tried to keep it very, very simple, like things that make me happy but were achievable. Like, yes, I wanted to be a writer and that would make me happy, but I didn't have too much control over that. So what could I do that would make me happy that was within my reach? And I thank God I came up with this memory of dating a guy in high school who sang in a church choir. And I did that with him over the holidays one year, and we sang Christmas carols, and it was just so much fun. I loved the Christmas carols. I loved singing in the rehearsals every week, and I loved the harmonies and my fellow singers, and then singing in church on Christmas Eve with all the decorations. I just had this magical memory of it, with, you know, colored lights and trees and wonderful scents and sounds. And so I thought, oh, I'll join a choir. That's it. That's one thing I can do that'll be fun. And I walked around looking for a choir. And by the way, I'm not religious. And so that was kind of like, I was hoping to find something that wasn't church-oriented. But I walked into Grace Church at 10th Street and Broadway, and it was just one of the most beautiful churches I've ever seen. And I found someone, and I said, do you have a choir? And they said, yes. And I said, how would I join? And they said, well, here's the number of the choir director. Give him a call. And I called him. His name was Frank Smith. And he said, sure, you know, come in and audition. And I just panicked because the last time I had done this, you know, I didn't have to audition. They said, you want to sing? Sure, come sing. No problem. And I don't have a particularly good voice. And I remembered auditioning once in my life in high school, and I panicked so badly that I sang off tune, even though I don't have a beautiful voice, I can sing in tune. But at the audition, I was so scared, I sang terribly. And I was so afraid that the same thing would happen. So I showed up for the audition and basically just begged him to let me in. And I said to him what I just said to you. I said, look, I can sing, I promise. I don't have a pretty voice, but I can sing in tune, but I may not be able to do that for you right now. And he just laughed and he said, well, you have to audition, so go. And miraculously, I did not sing out of tune. And so I sang a song, and when I was finished, he was such a sweet guy. He goes, yeah, you don't have the most beautiful voice in the world, but you can sing in tune. Welcome to the choir. And I showed up for choir rehearsal, and I've told this story so many times, so I'm sorry if I've told you this story before, but I will never forget showing up for the first rehearsal, because at the last choir experience, we just sang Christmas carols, like Oh Holy Night, and this was a serious choir, and we were singing Handel's Messiah, and that Handel's Messiah is like hundreds of pages long, and I opened it, you know, he says, open up to a certain page. I looked down, and I actually knew how to read music, but I did not know how to sight sing. And I was not familiar enough with Handel's Messiah. Like, I'd heard the Hallelujah chorus, that's it. And so I looked down, and I couldn't turn those words into sounds. I just did not know how. And everyone else around me is having no problem. They're singing away and all these harmonies. And, you know, it was very terrifying, very intimidating, but it was also the most beautiful sound I'd ever heard. So I was determined to learn how to do this. And it's not that hard. I mean, after a few weeks, I just got into, you know, I got the hang of it. And I also cheated. I would, whenever we would play, learn a piece, you know, I would buy the music and listen to it and cheat by, you know, so it wasn't so much sight singing as hearing it and then learning what these notes look like to translate them to sound.
Maybe that's what Kate McKinnon did for Hallelujah on Saturday Night Live, which was so well done. And you got a book out of it too. Tell us about the book.
So I wrote a book called Imperfect Harmony, and it's about the history and science of singing. And I used my own story so I sing with the Choral Society of Grace Church. And it's a community choir. You don't have to be a member of the church to sing in this choir. So it's people from all different faiths or no faith at all. And I wrote a book about, you know, the history and science of singing, but I used my experience as an anchor. So I begin with my story, and it's the way it's structured is I picked various pieces of music that we've sung. And using each piece as a launching pad to talk about the history of people singing together, to introduce all these scientific studies about music and what it does to the body. And all these studies just prove what singers already know, that it feels good and it does good things for you.
I have the musical heart, and I have the worst voice in the United States. I've tried out for my high school glee club, and they suggest I try the band. So when I used to, go to dance, and I'd be dancing close with the young lady, and I'd be singing in her ear. If she came back to me after the first thing, she really had to like me, because I sing all the time, and Barbara has to listen to me, but I have a terrible voice.
Do you really have a terrible voice, or do you just think you have a terrible voice?
I don't know if you heard that in the background, but my producer just said he's got a terrible voice. Staying with books, you wrote one about Duke University's parapsychology laboratory. What sparked the interest, and how did you obtain Duke's cooperation?
My books begin as something else. Like that book I wrote after I had written a book about the NYPD's cold case squad called The Restless Sleep. And that was very, very interesting and a lot of fun for a book about murder. But this unit goes back through old unsolved homicides to see which, if any, that they can solve. And they work to solve these old cases. And to write that book, I researched and wrote about, like, a history of unsolved murders. So I went back and looked at all the murders, well, to a certain extent, looked at all the murders that have not been solved in the past 100 years to see what I could learn about which murders don't get solved. And the research was fascinating, and spending all the time with this detective was fascinating, but ultimately very depressing, because at the end of every story I researched, there was somebody who died. And it's terrible. And it's terrible how many people die. It's terrible how many people are murdered. And it's very, very terrible how many people are murdered and those murderers are never found and brought to justice. So when that book was done, I thought, oh, my God, I want to write about puppies or something. And I thought, you know, what's more fun than a ghost story? I'll write a ghost story. And so I wrote a proposal to write about this ghost story that I had heard as a child about a house in Harlem, uptown. And I wrote a proposal for that. Also, by the way, conveniently forgetting that at the end of every ghost story is also a dead person. I don't know why that didn't occur to me at the time. But that proposal went around, and an editor saw it and liked the idea, but she had an even better idea. She had grown up outside of Duke University, and she heard that they once had a parapsychology laboratory there, but she didn't know what happened inside this lab. And she thought, why don't you write about that lab and the scientists the way you wrote about the cold case squad and the detectives? And I thought, oh my God, that's a much better idea than my idea. I would love to do that. So I contacted a woman named Sally Rhinefeather, who is the daughter of J.B. Rhine, who had started and who would run that lab at Duke University from the 1930s to the 1960s. And I explained, you know, who I was and what I had in mind, and I told her that I would be very fair and objective, the same way that I was with the detectives. You know, I would, you know, tell the story from your point of view or from the scientist's point of view and not from mine. And she was thrilled, and Duke University was also thrilled and wonderful. All the archives for the parapsychology laboratory are in their special collections library down in Durham, North Carolina, and they just loved the idea that someone was, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of boxes of stuff there, and they were just thrilled that somebody was going to come down and explore them. So I went down, took my cats, and went down there and spent months going through all these boxes of archives. It was one of the more interesting things I've done with my life. The best part was, so this lab, the years that it was in operation, it's still in operation, but the years it was in operation in Duke was from the 1930s to the 1960s. And it was very famous at the time. So anytime anything weird happened in America and also outside of America, they would write to the scientists in the lab and say, you know, I'm seeing ghosts, or I'm hearing these strange things, or these things are moving in my house. What's going on? And they would write the lab. So in these archives at Duke University are thousands of letters from people all over the country and the world talking about the weird things that happened to them. So it's a treasure trove of strange occurrences in America during this period of time.
One of the people, and this is another one of these asides, who probably interviewed you during your early Echo days is the Duke graduate, one of the New York people. Do you remember who that might be?
No.
Joe King.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
About the time that the Cold Case book came out, I think that was also about the time that mystery series Cold Case that was set in Philadelphia was popular. So that should have gotten you a push anyhow on the book.
I don't remember.
And tell us about your current work in progress about Blackwell's Island.
Well, that was another case where I had one idea and my editor had a better idea. But my favorite thing, along with writing, is the research that goes with it. I just love having a fascinating topic to immerse myself in for a couple of years. And one of the places that I often end up researching is the Municipal Archives in New York, where all the city records are kept. And I wanted to write a book about the municipal archives, and just so that people could know that this cool place exists and what kind of records are there. And so I wrote a proposal about the municipal archives, and in that proposal was just a quick story about Blackwell's Island. And Blackwell's Island is what Roosevelt Island, the island in the East River, was called in the 19th century. And in the 19th century, it was owned by the city, and they put a bunch of institutions there, like a lunatic asylum, a couple of prisons, and hospitals for poor people. It was basically all the people that they didn't want to deal with. They were going to isolate on this island in these institutions, and it was a terrible, terrible place. So there was a short thing about that in my proposal. So my publisher read the proposal, and they discussed it, and somebody said, you know, this Blackwell's Island bit is interesting. Why doesn't she just write a book about Blackwell's Island? And as soon as my editor brought it up to me, I thought, oh, my God, that's a great idea, you know, because it is interesting. It's there's this lunatic asylum. And so I said, yes, I would love to write a book about Blackwell's Island. And I just finished it. I just handed it in. But it involved researching these institutions, the lunatic asylum and the workhouse, which was a prison, and the penitentiary, which led to Rikers Island. And it's just one horrible story after another of how badly we mistreated these people. And the worst was, I had just finished the epilogue talking about my book ends in 1895, and they had just separated charity. It used to be in New York, charity and correction was one department. So the same people who were responsible for dispensing charity were the same people handling and managing convicts and prisoners in New York. So really, really bad idea. So they finally separated it. And the penitentiary on Blackwell's Island, which was a horrible, horrible place, they proposed closing it and building a new penitentiary and a workhouse, which was also a prison, on Rikers Island. And they had all these wonderful plans for the state of the art corrections facilities, and it was going to be good, and it was going to fix all the problems on Blackwell's Island, and it was a happy-ish ending. And from there, like a week later, I went to a screening for this documentary that Bill Moyers made about Rikers Island.
Right.
And we are all going to hell for what is happening there and what we're doing to people there. I don't care who people think the inmates are there. For the most part, they're detainees. They haven't even been convicted of anything. But we are abusing them so horribly. It's just, there is no exaggerating how terrible that place is. It should be shut down immediately. So, yeah.
In 1952, my grandmother, who lived in Yorkville, got very sick. She had fallen and broken her hip, and she was alone. And finally, they found her, and they called my mother, and my mother said, call an ambulance right away. And she had money, but this ambulance took her to what was called by a different name before. It was Roosevelt Island, and she wound up dying in the hospital there. And her brother was livid that they had allowed, that my mother had allowed my grandmother, her mother-in-law, to be taken to what was then called Welfare Island.
Yes, I wrote about that in my epilogue.
Yeah, and it just had this whole stigma. That's where the ambulance happened to go. She didn't say take her to the welfare hospital. You know, then after she died, she had left me enough money to buy my first car, so she obviously wasn't a welfare person. But and then it became this Tony place to live with the trams and all that. So it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, actually, it's a mixed income kind of place. It's not Tony. I mean, there are Tony areas, but it's definitely affordable as well.
I know some very wealthy people that lived there. One of the DuPont heirs, who was a friend, he lived there, and he did all right.
Well, one of the remaining structures from the lunatic asylum is now very expensive housing.
Oh, yeah? Wow.
That kills me.
along the way, you also became an NPR commentator and producer.
I don't do that anymore. I went through a period where I was doing commentaries for NPR, and that was fun. I mean, radio's fun, you know. You definitely know.
How'd you get involved in that? And tell us about some of your features.
Well, a friend had a friend there, Art Silverman, and so I submitted a piece about drumming with Eric Clapton, and he liked it, and we ended up doing a bunch of pieces together. But radio is a very different kind of writing. I think I'm more a books person. Like, I like a more immersive long form of writing. Radio, I think it takes a skill that maybe I'm not the best at, but I've done pieces. I did, why do I keep doing these sad pieces? But I did a story about this fire in West Virginia. I forget what year it was, but it was Christmas Eve, and a terrible fire took place in this family home, and five of the children died in the fire, except a few days later, the family decided that the children did not die in the fire, but that they were abducted. And they never accepted that the children died, and they put up this billboard with pictures of all the children saying, "Our children are missing. Have you seen our children?" And they never accepted that the children died.
Wow.
Oh, it's a very sad story. I researched it and tried to have an open mind, but I concluded that the children had, in fact, died in the fire.
It's interesting that you focus on what you do well and what you don't do as well. I've written a news stories and columns and articles and poetry and a novella. And the one thing I find the hardest thing to write, and to some people it seems to come easy, is short stories.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that you're limited by the shortness where you have to both develop characterization and the plot and the environment. And I don't know how all these people do so well, but I think it's by far the hardest thing to write. Yeah, so,
I think fiction is impossible.
Yeah. Well, it's...
For me.
You can build something. I've done a couple of things on that.
But it's a different talent that I don't think
have. Over the years, the web-based social media services like Facebook and Twitter have taken away the thunder of the services like Echo and The Well. What's the status of Echo now?
Echo is still around, but it's a very tiny, tiny place. You know, it's a small number of us who've been online for years and will probably stay until we die. And that's okay. I mean, very few things last forever. And I actually love a lot of the services, you know, that have taken its place. I mean, there's pluses and minuses to each of them, but it's exciting, all these things that have come along and continue to come along. I love it. I love Twitter. I love all of it.
You had it out on the commercial thing, being run out the panics for a long time. Did you bring it back home, or is it still run out of a commercial place?
Well, it's still hosted, it's now virtual computers, virtual machines at another company, and
okay.
I'm at home again. So, yeah, it's come full circle.
By the way, if there's some of the URLs of the various sites and the book things and the organizations and the Becca, I'll include it in the article that I put together after the interview. What's next for you?
I am actually starting a job next week at the ASPCA. I'm very much an animal person, and I'm going. They 2 years ago, the ASPCA opened a kitten nursery. I don't know if you know about this, but every year there's an explosion of kitten births, and people bring kittens in thousands to Animal Care and Control, the city shelter. And Animal Care and Control is obligated to take every animal that's brought to them. They cannot turn any animals away. But what happens, very sadly and horribly, is that neonatal kittens are euthanized because it's very hard to keep them alive. So
yeah.
The ASPCA started the kitten nursery to address that and to take in all these young kittens and try to keep them alive. And I went to one class, and I think if I'm remembering correctly, their mortality rate is 13%, which is very, very good. So they're still a very young organization, or rather this department is a young department, and I think they said they took in a little over 1,000. So 900 kittens are living that would have been euthanized normally. So next week I start training to work in the kitten nursery to work with neonatal kittens. Doesn't that sound like – it's like the book I wanted to write after the cold case book. I'm going to be working with kittens.
Yeah, we have over the years, we must have had 30 cats over the years. We're down to, after this one to die that I mentioned, we're down to 2. And the dog, but we also feed the deer outside. Deer eat on my lawn, and we've got squirrels. It's just terrific being with animals. It's just
exactly. I am so happy about this job. Like, I was reading about all their different departments and all the things that they do, New York and also across the country, all these different programs that they've got going. It's just like, I am so proud to work at this place.
And is there a book out of it?
I would love to write a book about it, but I don't know how they're going to feel about it, so we shall see.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Stacey Horn?
I think we've covered it. I think the audience knows Stacey Horn very well. Yeah, I can't think of anything. Your questions were very thorough.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stacey. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I'm honored to be on your show. Thank you so much for inviting me. I had a good time.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I've blogged at medium.com and published the daily newspaper mentioned above. Send any comments to me or questions to at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website for the URLs of previous shows, and I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with Marriage College President Mark Jerome. That's Monroe College President Mark Jerome, and every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings. Okay, Henry Mancini, take us off.
What piece is it?
It's Peter Gunn, the theme from Peter Gunn, which was
that you began with,
which was I opened with, yeah. However, that's not coming up, so we'll do something else. Good night, everybody.